Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
The following program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cane5.com.
You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby. You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby. You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby, broadcast live to the cosmos on the Heritage Radio Network.
Good Monday morning or Monday afternoon to everybody, whatever we are. We're getting a late start regardless, thanks to Brooklyn traffic today. Yeah. This is another episode of Cutting the Curd. I'm your host, Ann Saxelby. My co-host is Sophie Schlesinger. And today we are very lucky to have a guest in studio with us, which is quite a rare treat indeed. Jeremy Stevenson, who is the cheesemaker at Springbrook Farm in Vermont.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Thanks for coming on the show. So, but before we even get started talking about anything else, there's these two gorgeous pieces of cheese sitting here on the table.
Yes. Not even pieces, I'd say they're wedges.
They're giant wedges.
Giant wedges of cheese.
There's like 5 pounds of cheese in front of us. Can you tell us, you were saying that there's a difference.
Yeah.
These are both wheels of Tarentaise, your signature cheese.
Well, I brought those down to illustrate the seasonal difference that we're seeing now that we've started year-round production. And the first one is late May, just as we were letting the herd out onto the pasture last year. And the other one is late June. And you can see a difference in the color and taste.
Wow.
Will follow with that appearance, the difference in the appearance.
Well, I know this is it's horrible to do visual things on the radio, but if you were all sitting in the studio, you would see this wheel from late May is quite pale in color. It's it's a little bit, like a milkier, sort of a very soft yellow. And then the wheel from late June is quite golden and intense looking. It's a really deep, deep yellow. What causes that difference?
Well, I'm quite sure it's the grass. It's the keratin in the grass. And that's giving it that yellow color, not fat, but definitely coming from the pasture. Our animals are fed hay through the winter now. We don't use fermented feed because that won't work with our cheese.
Mm-hmm.
But so they're essentially grass-fed year-round with grain supplement. But there you can see the difference between really nicely made hay and fresh grass.
It's
they're going to get a little bit of hay in the barn too when they're in the barn, but predominantly it's grass.
And does it have anything to do with the fact that it's predominantly Jersey milk? Does that also create a stronger difference in coloration or not so much?
Well, yes. I mean, Jersey milk tends to give that sort of color, but if you that we expect, you know, the sort of the more yellow color towards a yellow hue. But on the other hand, you know, our winter cheese can be quite pale.
Huh.
So
It's the grass. It's the proof is in the pudding.
Yeah,
in the grass.
And what I like about these two pieces of cheese is that in other ways they look very similar, and so we're trying to maintain consistent production practices, which allow the seasonal variation to come out. So we don't want to just make cheese one way one day and do it another way the next day. We make the cheese essentially the same way every day, though we do adjust to the changes in components. So we adjust to the milk, but we try to be very consistent with our...
Well, I can say from experience that your cheeses are very consistent. They're always, they have that wonderful, dense, smooth paste of an Alpine-style cheese. There is a difference in flavor, certainly, but not one that swings all over the spectrum. Can you talk to us a little bit about where this tradition of seasonal cheese making comes from and how you guys decided to... I guess it's like a five-part question, but then how you decided to adopt that and now why you've gone back the other way to making cheese year-round.
Well, I mean, I think our cheese begins, of course, in the Alps. I mean, we have to look back at 1,000 years or more of cheese-making practices. And I know that you've talked about this before with other guests that, this was all about food preservation and having a surplus of milk on a seasonal basis, and then making sure that that milk could be preserved in some way, and so that's why we have this cheese. But this cheese in the United States, this Tarentaise, began with the Putnams at Thistle Hill Farm,
which is quite near to you guys in Vermont.
About 20 miles away.
Okay.
Yeah. And they went to France and learned from a French cheesemaker how to produce this cheese, and then, of course, adapted that process to their farm and their herd of cows. So we are now a continuation of that on a second farm. And what we're doing in going year-round is we're trying to make economic sense of what's essentially 40 milking cows, a small dairy barn.
Mm-hmm.
You would never survive selling fluid milk. We hope to be able to use our cheese making equipment and the milk that we're getting from our farm to support the farm.
Absolutely. And 40 cows, they make quite a bit of milk for cheese and for cheese production. I mean, it's not a little amount of cheese that you can get from 40 cows.
No. But though our cheese retails at a fairly high price, the actual return that we get is somewhat less. So, everybody has to get paid for their work in the process of getting it to market. So,
could you break that down for us a little bit? That's actually something that we've never really discussed on the show before.
Yeah.
Like, what are the costs that go into making cheese, and how do you figure that into your price per pound when you sell to somebody like me?
Well, I think generally speaking, by at the end of the day, when you see a retail price, a cheesemaker would be fortunate to be realizing 50% of that, probably less, maybe a little closer to 40%. So along the way, you have a distribution network and possibly even two distributors in between its final destination with the retailer. And as you know, it costs money to sell cheese.
Yeah. And just on the making side of things, like, what are the costs that you guys experience on the farm? You said everybody's labor has to be duly compensated. So, yeah, what are some of those costs?
In terms of labor?
What it actually costs to produce milk. What does it cost to feed cows and, all the stuff that goes into it? Because I feel like that's an issue with artisan cheese. People look at it and they might shrink
yeah.
from the price, but
right.
it's
well,
quite a lot
true.
That goes into it.
Yeah. Again, I like to talk in percentages because that's kind of the way I think, in proportions.
Uh-huh.
And so I would say of the dollars that we bring in from selling our cheese wholesale that we are probably seeing 60 to 70% of that go into our expenses, our cost, our overhead.
Wow.
But you see, it's a little tricky. I mean, I can tell you what a pound of cheese costs us to make. We're not at break even right now, but as we go into year round production, we can hit mm-hmm. that point. So if you're making cheese for 6 months, and you can see how those numbers would work, you're not
going
to cover
the costs.
Because
those cows are there all year round.
You've got year round costs, and you can't tell a cheesemaker to just go and hibernate for 6 months and come back when they want.
Although I'm sure you would like that. Hibernate in a warm place, maybe.
Oh, boy. No, it's actually nice to be making cheese year-round. It's a lot of work. It doesn't stop, but, you know, it's enjoyable.
Yeah.
Making cheese is really great. And you can stay in touch with your product really well that way. You don't have that.
I always thought that would be hard to, like, have that seasonal change. It's like going back to school or something. You're just all used to one way, and then all of a sudden, you know, kind of makes your head hurt to try to jump back into it. So it's probably nice to have a little bit more of a year-round rhythm.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, you know, it's amazing what you do remember after 5 months. You know, there's a lot of muscle memory there as well as just, you know, what's in your head. So, excuse me. In fairness, you know, I mean, I wouldn't say that seasonal cheesemakers are coming back and really scratching their heads, you know.
Yeah, no, definitely. Definitely.
They know what they're doing.
Absolutely. But I guess I was just thinking I'm more of like if I were a cheesemaker, I know I'd be like, oh man.
Yeah.
I've got to get back just it's a whole other routine.
It is. Yeah.
But so the Tarentaise is your signature cheese, and I know you guys recently started making another cheese. Could you tell us about that, and what was the thought process that goes into that?
Yeah, well, Tarentaise, I suppose, I guess I'm not clear exactly what the definition of farmstead cheese is, but I would say that it is cheese made on the farm where the milk is produced. That's the definition I've always held. And so Tarentaise is a farmstead cheese. By that definition, we're now making Reading Raclette, which is a semi-soft cheese. And it's nice to make this cheese because we can use the same equipment that we're using for Tarentaise and the same aging space. But what's exciting about it is that we're going to be using the milk from a second farm, which is also quite near. It's within 15 miles.
Wow.
And that farm has 20 Jersey cows, so it's even smaller than ours. And we've made arrangements with them to buy the milk and pay them a premium for that milk, buy that milk exclusively. And
you're buying their entire production?
Right.
Wow.
Well,
wow.
They sell a little bit directly to customers that want to buy raw milk at the farm,
mm-hmm.
and they raise some other animals and use milk for that. But so we'll be buying what they can sell us for Raclette.
That's amazing. And so, what's the history of that farm? Is that like one of these ancient Vermont dairy farms that's been in for generations?
I'm not so sure that it's been there for generations. It'd be great to get Lisa Kamen, who's the farmer, on to talk to you about that. But you know, she's a very committed farmer that's been working with cows for at least 15 years, I'm sure, and maybe, you know, before then. And it's, again, she's very, very involved in selling locally and making a go of it, but we're just happy that she has excellent milk and we can use it for a really nice cheese, and it'll help both of us.
Absolutely.
And
do you envision your production of Tarentaise increasing to other farms in the area, for instance buying milk from other farms to make more Tarentaise, or maybe doing something like what the Putnams did with you, where you would give another farm access to your recipe and make the tarantaise spread across more farms in Vermont?
Well, you know, I can't answer that. I would say, looking at what we've got in front of us with year-round production of tarantaise and getting Redding Raclette off and running, we've got our hands full. So when we crack that nut, you know,
that's a nut across the bridge when you come.
It would be really nice to think about a lot of other things, but right now we're just going to focus on making our cheese well and selling it all.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. We're working on that end of it too. I don't know. It seems like it might be a good time to take a little break. And when we come back, we can chat a little bit more about Springbrook Farm and the other excellent work that you guys do there in addition to making tasty cheese. So Stay with us.
This is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune in to The Main Course Sundays at 12 p.m. with hosts Patrick Martins and Katie Kiefer. They examine issues from the interconnected worlds of agriculture, cuisine, and sustainability. They sit down with key players in the chain from producer to consumer, farmers, distributors, chefs, activists, and journalists. The Main Course explores every important component of the eating experience, how the farmers raise their product, the distribution channels that move the product, how the chefs prepare it, and how ethics and policy affect everyone involved. Again, that's The Main Course, Sundays at noon on the Heritage Radio Network.
And we're back on Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Ann Saxelby. My co-host is Sophie Schlesinger. And our guest today is Jeremy Stevenson, a cheesemaker at Springbrook Farm. If you have questions for us, we are in a constant collection of questions for a reader response show that we're going to do at some point when we gather lots of interesting questions. But you can email us at info@heritageradionetwork.com. We look forward to hopefully answering some of your cheesy queries. So we wanted to lead off the second half of the show talking about the other side of Springbrook Farm, the side that that lives in conjunction with the cheese. Springbrook Farm is also a foundation, Farms for City Kids, that does a lot of great work bringing kids from cities up to the farm and doing different farm activities to sort of help them develop different skills than they would learn in their normal environment. So, Jeremy, can you tell us a little bit about the foundation, who started it, and how it got off the ground?
Yeah. The Farms for City Kids Foundation was founded about 14 years ago by Jim and Carly Hagedorn, who have been consistent, reliable supporters of it and believe in the mission of the Farms for City Kids Foundation deeply. So the idea, if the education director, Rob McCree, were here, he'd explain that there are really, if you were to take three key goals of the educational program on the farm, which is essentially what the foundation was started to promote, he'd say first it's to give these students an experience which shows them the value of teamwork and cooperation. Going to a setting outside, you know, and away from their normal environment, and learning about each other in a new place, and developing a greater respect for each other and understanding strengths and weaknesses. And so that's one. Another one would be to foster an understanding of agriculture and the environment and how the two relate, how important the two are to the food we eat, and making a connection for the students between something they see on a grocery store shelf and the earth, you know, making that real to kids.
It's a pretty big leap. I mean, if you've just, you know, shopping in the supermarket to, you know, being on your farm, it's a, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't make that connection until I was like 24. Yeah.
That's what I was just thinking, you know, and when I was that age, we had outdoor ed, which was basically like a ropes course that they took us for maybe 2 days. But I was wondering, could you tell us maybe some of the tasks and activities that they do on the farm?
Yeah, the kids show up on a Monday, and they leave on a Friday. When they show up on Monday, they get off a bus, and they're usually not in a vehicle again for that week. So they walk over to the dormitory, get settled in, get oriented, and then on Tuesday they'll begin with what's a fairly routine day. There's a general schedule that is followed by all of the classes that visit. There are chores in the morning. Then there's some learning that they go back to the dorm and have a couple of hours of discussion and, you know, various activities that they do in more of a classroom setting, and then back out to do more chores, and then they're so the day is divided into activities, and the activities vary with the seasonal activities of the farm. Probably the most consistent thing is the cheese aging room. So they quite often come in and help with aging in the cheese house. Mm-hmm. And then they also have meals. Yeah, no. They get up, do chores, they go back, have breakfast, then they have a classroom session. Right. And so they get
Sounds pretty good. Yeah, to me. Yeah. I want to sign up.
Yeah.
How do they usually respond to the week? I mean, I could foresee some kids kind of retaliating against the idea of, you know, daily chores. Or do you think it's something that they embrace because it's so much outdoor time?
No, I think that sometimes it's really hard for them.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's part of the process, you know, of teaching them that you have to, in order to make food, you have to do work. And that work happens every day.
Right.
It doesn't matter whether you're tired or not. Things have to be done. Animals need to be taken care of. And the seasons are relentless. You know, they come and go, and you have to do certain things at certain times. So
right.
They react in different ways, but at the end of the week, I think they have a tremendous feeling of accomplishment. And I visited a few of their kind of wrap-up sessions where they have an awards ceremony, and every child is recognized for something special that they've accomplished during the week. And, you know, they all have different experiences. And so, I think they go away with a great sense of accomplishment, because it's a big culture shock and it's a big change.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, and even just the aging alone, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about what they do, because, you know, I find it difficult to lift a whole wheel of Tarantes sometimes. It's they're not small cheeses.
Well, yeah, they're fifth and sixth graders, and you'd be amazed at how well they do with it.
Wow.
But that's where, you know, teamwork comes in. And if one student's having difficulty, for whatever reason, turning a wheel, others will come over and help, and that's, you know, that's part of what happens. And, you know, we don't rely on them to do a really good job at what they're doing. We assume that they might get close to it, you know, so we don't rely on them for labor. You know, it's certainly not in our plans, but we definitely want them to experience the work and get a sense of that.
And so would you say that education is more based on those kinds of like community experiences or, you know, sort of like you said, teamwork? Do you guys focus at all on sort of the biology and the, you know, the science end of cheesemaking with them? Or is it more just about the experience of doing work on the farm?
The ed staff is very skilled at reading a group and figuring out pretty quickly early on in the week what's going to really click with a given mix of kids. So some kids are very science oriented. You know, some kids want numbers. They want to know the yield on the cheese. They're very interested in all that. For other kids, math just doesn't work.
So I maybe, was one of those kids.
You know, maybe you just go into social history, or you can talk about the microbes in the cheese, and maybe that's going to wake up a lot of thoughts and a lot of interest. I tell you, they do get fascinated by that microbiology once you start checking in with them about it. I mean, they get that. It's explained to them as they come in the door. We have a nice viewing windows that they can look down on the make room through. And the ed staff will explain to them all the basics of cheese making. So they never look at a wheel of cheese or a piece of cheese the same again, I would reckon.
Yeah.
Well, and these are fifth and sixth graders. I don't know if I mentioned that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a great age.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like on the cusp of junior high, but not quite there.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, they come into coming into the aging room at the smell hits them. You know,
yeah.
It's very what?
What are those reactions like?
Well, they run the gambit, you know, and sometimes one of them ends up sitting out in the hallway for whatever reason, but there's a lot of mold in there too, you know.
That at my store at the Essex Market, yeah, there are a lot of interesting comments when kids walk by.
Yeah, they're really honest, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Tell you what they think.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, and they work with the oldest of the cheeses, so we don't expect them to work with our younger wheels, which are very delicate and you know, take a lot of precise care. But you know, when a wheel's 8-9 months old, it's
pretty
safe. Just fine for them to turn the wheel. We just don't want them to drop it on their toes.
Yeah.
Right.
That's really cool though. Cheese as lens for, you know, any subject you can imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of food kind of fits that bill a little bit, which is a nice thing about visiting a farm for a week if you're a student.
Now, when I see them in there, it makes me realize how strong the basic concept is. That, you know, the what the Hagedorn's got going there was, you know, it's gone on all this time, and it may not have always had cheese. The cheese has only been there 3 years, but kids have been experiencing this. Last year, we had 800 children, each of them spending about a week at a time, so.
And so how did the Hagedorns decide to make that leap from having an educational farm to making cheese?
Well, I think that they wanted to make cheese, for sure. But and I think there were a lot of happy coincidences. So, you know, I think the Putnams at Thistle Hill had been having great success with their cheese and felt that there was a, you know, that more could be sold, but they weren't going to expand their farm at that time, and there were some connections there. You know, the folks knew each other that somehow, and so the two farms came up with this idea of having a second cheese at Springbrook Farm. And I think, you know, that there was also an economic component there, but I think more it was a question of adding to the educational mission. I mean, it really enhances what's going on there with the education. And the investment that it takes to produce a good cheese is really quite a lot. And so,
well, I think
it's not a big, quick money maker, but we hope to make good economic sense of it.
Absolutely. Well, it seems like you guys are on the right track. I mean, at the American Cheese Society Awards last year, you guys got quite some accolades. I forget, was it best in show, or was it number one overall in your category? I'm sorry, I can't remember.
We got first in our category and third place best of show. So there were two other cheeses.
Oh, right. Pleasant Ridge won again for like the third time in 10 years.
They got they got first best of show, and Allison Hooper and Vermont Creamery got a second. And we got the third, and we were just delighted. I mean, it was fantastic. But I certainly don't take full credit for that. I take, you know, we were set up very well, and I was taught very well by a French cheesemaker who was hired to train me, and he's devoted to what we're doing as well. So,
well, that was my next question. What was your agricultural education like? Did you grow up having access to agriculture as a kid, and how did you get into cheese in the first place?
Well, we moved a lot when I was a kid, and so at times we actually lived out in the country and near water and farms, and so I had a taste of that. But we also lived in the city at times. I've always loved being around farms, but I've also always worked with my hands. And so about 10 years ago, I decided that I was not going to be a blacksmith anymore, and started getting into becoming aware of high-quality foods. And that led to spending a year in Italy, and later on I was doing some importing, and after that working with a distributor. So then the opportunity to work at Springbrook Farm came up, and I was really happy to get that opportunity, and that's when I learned about cheese making.
Wow. And so tell us about your consultant. I mean, I think it's a really fantastic and smart thing for a cheesemaker to do, because like you said, it's based on centuries of tradition, and it's not easy. So
that's what impressed me a lot about the Putnams when I first met them and saw their operation, is that they had gone to France, and they didn't try to copy a cheese, but they tried to learn something from people that had a great deal of knowledge. And Alex Pellissier came to work with them early on, and I think they made cheese together for a short time, and then he certainly had a lot more time with me, I think 6 years later, 7 years later, when the Springbrook operation started. So Alex was trained both in school there, but also worked up in the Alpage, making Beaufort. So, his family is a farming family in the Alps, and they're dairy farmers. But
can't ask for much better, background than that.
Phenomenal. And I just related to all that so much because of my experience in Italy and kind of where I was sort of awakened to,
to the beauty of cheese.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've learned a bazillion things from Alex, but can you point out maybe one or two things that surprised even you after having had experience selling cheese before?
I'd have to say that his approach, the way he would put it is that what we do is we, as cheesemakers of an artisanal product, a traditional product like this, we adapt to the milk. We don't adapt the milk to us. So that is a huge distinction between the cheeses being made by most small cheesemakers in this country and in Europe. We're not tweaking our milk so that we can add certain ingredients and then walk away from it. And we're going to work with the vicissitudes, the variations that occur through the season. So that, that's a key.
Yeah, that's a
key point that he makes.
Shift.
Yeah, and I think also it isn't a recipe. I generally don't say that we have a cheese making recipe. Mm-hmm. I mean, we do have pretty standard procedure and standard ingredients, but we have to feel our way through each make. We got to know when to cut the curd and when it's cooked,
Right.
Yeah.
And So there's a lot of learning that you that is all about the feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know if that answers your question, but
oh no, that's a perfect answer. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I feel like Sophie, did you have other questions? Oh, you know what I wanted to ask? I wanted to ask because actually we're getting a little bit short on time. How do people find out about the program and how do they apply? And yeah, those are two.
Website farmsforcitykids.org.
Farmsforcitykids.org. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Which is quite informative. And sbfcheese.org as well is a cheese website. We're actually about to revamp our web presence, and the two will be merged to one. And cheese will be a page on the overall farm website.
Cool.
And So that's probably the best way to find out about it.
Okay, great. And then can anybody apply? Is it is the application done by teachers, parents?
On the website, you'll find information about applying. It's generally for schools.
Right.
So
we can't go.
Yeah, maybe we can.
you can come and visit.
Okay.
Great. Yeah. But no, you couldn't just put together. Well, I won't say anything. I think you should talk to our ed director.
And I know where to find
him. He's a creative guy. Yeah. I'm sure he can come up with some way of doing.
We'll just retake like algebra or something and get in a class and go.
Yeah.
But it's geared to school kids. And by the way, most of them are from New York and Boston, though we welcome, I know he welcomes applicants from all over. This is a service that's paid for by the farm, by the foundation. We don't ask the schools to pay anything other than transportation to the farm.
Wow.
So
I think, well, it's funny. I just think, you know, it's an awesome, amazing mission. I think though that like this kind of education could be useful for kids of all ages. I can think of plenty of adults who would also really benefit from that kind of work.
Yeah.
Like it's an eye opener.
Yeah. No, it's great. You know, it raises awareness of food and what we're doing with our land.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. Well, Sophie, what do you think? Did you have any other questions?
I think that was it. Just the contact information was pretty important. So that's good. Got that ready to go.
Yeah. I can give you a phone number.
Sure. Yeah, why the heck not? Your phone's going to be ringing off the hook. No, I'm just kidding.
our general phone number at the farm is 802-484-1236.
1236. Yeah. All right. Well, hopefully we have some parents listening in out there that can take advantage of this and get their kids involved in a program in the future. But, well, thank you so much, Jeremy, for taking time to be on the show.
In the studio.
It's great to be here.
I know. It's so exciting. And for bringing these gorgeous cheeses.
Yes.
Can't wait to try. Well, we will be back next Monday with another episode of Cutting the Curd. Until then, I don't know, be cheesy.
You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby. Listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby. You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby, broadcast live to the cosmos on the Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. And now here's some behind-the-scenes food news with Katie Kiefer.
On meetingplace.com this week, Lisa M. Keefe, one of their principal writers, published the following article about the USDA's child nutrition program. She reports that on Tuesday, the USDA began implementing new rules that are intended to put more locally grown agricultural products on school children's plates. Part of the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act of 2010, which was signed by President Obama in December, the rules allow schools and other providers to, quote, give preference to unprocessed, locally grown, and locally raised agricultural products when buying food for the national school lunch, school breakfast, special milk, child and adult care, fresh fruit and vegetable, and summer food service programs. Quote, this rule is an important milestone that will help ensure that our children have access to fresh produce and other agricultural products, said Agriculture Undersecretary Kevin Concannon in a news release. It will also give a much-needed boost to local farmers and agricultural producers. This is Katie Kiefer for Behind the Scenes Food News.
Did you know we have a beer show? Check out a small clip from Beer Sessions Radio.
All right, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43, and I'm here with Ray Dieter from the DBA Boys.
Hey, Jim.
Ray, this is a fun show. We're drinking Belgian beer. We're drinking Ichtigum, hanging out with the guys from the 124 Rabbit Club. And we got Don and Wendy from Van Berg and the Wolf. Well, let's go back a little bit to kind of build your pedigree. So the two of your top brands that we love and that you have now, Scaldis and Saison DuPont.
Yeah,
tell us how you met those guys, how you started working with them.
Well, Saison DuPont was really... that.
If you want to hear more, head over to heritageradionetwork.com where new episodes of Beer Sessions are posted every week in our archive. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. The following is a message from Heritage Foods USA. In the next few weeks, Heritage Foods USA will be offering an interesting variety of amazing products, ranging from top-quality seafood to their famous pork cuts. At the end of May, the Heritage team will go up to Maine to harvest fresh lobster with sustainable lobstermen. These delicious lobster are a perfect way to kick off the summer season. In the pork department, Heritage Foods USA will offer the maple-cured, smoked, boneless Heritage ham at an unbeatable price. This offer won't last long, so get them while you can. Place your order today at heritagefoodsusa.com or call 718-389-0985. That's 718-389-0985 to place your order with Andrea or Ashley. And don't forget to sign up for the email list and to check them on Facebook and Twitter to get in on their new products, deals, and offers from Heritage Foods USA.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.